When we hear about a big heist these days, it's not usually the result of bank robbers or art thieves. It's some hacker stealing data, credit card numbers, income tax records. This week, it was news of Russian hackers making off with a billion passwords. Steve Henn from our Planet Money team reports on how this crime spree is making some in Silicon Valley rethink their big data obsession.
If you want to know how valuable your data has become, think of it this way. It's bigger than Bitcoin. Accepted in places where your dollars aren't welcome. And look at what your data buys. Gmail alone is amazing and free. Facebook, Twitter, Google, all free. YouTube, including videos of ranchers serenading cattle with trombones. You can't buy any of these services with real money.
It's actually pretty tough to write a check to Google or Facebook or Twitter. What they want is your data.
That's Chris Segoyan. He studies data, security, and privacy, and he now works for the ACLU. These companies, he says, collect your data, combine it, manipulate it, use it to target ads, and make predictions about your behavior.
When a company's profit depends upon the amount of data that it collects, all of the incentives are aligned for it to collect as much data as possible.
Today, Google and Facebook combined are worth more than $500 billion. And the giant piles of data about us that they've collected, they're a honeypot. That data attracts hackers, identity thieves, cops, courts, stalkers, Chinese military hacking collectives, Russian mobsters, and intelligence analysts from the NSA. Stores like Target and Neiman Marcus can't keep this stuff safe. Even the NSA. The NSA couldn't stop Edward Snowden from walking out the door with big, huge piles of its most sensitive secrets.
The one thing that we've learned in the security industry, at least over the past 15 years, is that the attackers always win.
That's a hacker and computer encryption expert. He goes by the name Moxie Marlinspike.
If what you do is have a lot of really valuable information in one place and you try to secure that, you're going to lose. You know, like you lose every time. If you have the data, someone is going to get it.
Now, if you had a bank and guys in ski masks kept coming in and stealing your cash, there are a couple things you could do, right? You might hire more big, burly security guards, or you might decide to keep less cash lying around. And today in Silicon Valley, there's a dawning awareness that perhaps big vaults filled with sensitive data are not the best way to go. There's a small movement of developers and entrepreneurs who are trying to change the way the internet works. They're trying to build systems that collect as little data about you as possible.
I look at the companies that are making money off of personally identifiable information. They need to find another way to make money because that's nuclear waste.
So Nicosell has co-founded a social network that allows people to connect without collecting tons of personal information. Her company, Wickr, doesn't even know your password. This might sound fringy, but Wickr just landed a $30 million investment from one of the first people to back Facebook.
Will I kill those business models? The business models of making money off tons of little pieces of personal information? I hope so.
In most cases, folks will use Wickr for free. But Sell believes in certain circumstances, privacy and security are so important that people and companies will be willing to pay for it. The old-fashioned way, with real money. And she's not the only one searching for ways to limit the use of data as a digital currency. Moxie Marlinspike has launched a series of free, open-source apps that use end-to-end encryption to keep the content of messages or phone calls secret.
The point of cryptography is to trust algorithms and not people. You know, we shouldn't have to trust an individual or an organization to keep us safe or to behave appropriately. You know, we should be able to put our trust into math itself. I don't think we can expect, you know, an individual or organization to go to jail for us. But, you know, math doesn't have that problem.
You can't put math in jail.
No, you can't.
He says if the government served him with a subpoena or a hacker held a gun to his head and demanded the contents of your calls, he couldn't help them out. There would be nothing he could do. And he's saying to companies everywhere, go ahead, use my technology. I'm not even going to charge you for it. And maybe you'll be better off if you have less data lying around. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
To hack or not to hack? That is the question in Las Vegas this week at two conferences. One's called Black Hat, the other DEF CON. Many of the attendees are people who poke at websites, smartphones, and other wireless devices looking for security gaps that companies should fix. But even when they're hacking with good intentions, they can get into big trouble. NPR's Arthi Shahani reports.
Security researcher Logan Lam was supposed to be on stage giving a presentation. Instead, he's standing in a corner, literally trembling as he talks to me.
Well, I was going to be presenting, right? And because of these pressures put on me, I can't now.
Lam won't spell out the pressures, but it's a well-known fact in these hallways that companies threaten people who find weaknesses in their software. Lam, who's based in Knoxville, Tennessee, tested three well-known home alarm systems to see if they're easy to hack. He says he did this in his own apartment and at two friends' houses.
I pushed the cats off the kitchen table, throw all my gear on the table, and walk around trying to set things off and suppress them.
Lam found that inside a home, he could break the communication between the sensors that monitor movement and the keypad that tells the corporate network when an intruder has broken in. He could also fake an intruder to set off a false alarm. He says it was fairly easy because the makers of these wireless devices left them unencrypted.
So some guy with the right hardware can sit out in front of someone's home and listen in. That's pretty disconcerting, I think. So.
And which home security systems? By whom?
I can't go into that.
The companies Honeywell, ADT Corp, and Vivint were all named in the online summary of his research. None responded immediately to NPR's inquiry. Security researcher Jesus Molina did give his talk, and it went something like this.
At the hotel, which is a five-star luxury hotel, I was able to control every device in every room.
Molina, based in San Francisco, says he checked into a Starwood-owned hotel as a guest. The rooms were high-tech with an iPad that acted as a remote control for the appliances.
The TVs, the lights, the blinds.
And Molina noticed the iPad in his room was on the open guest network. So from his computer, he could see and record transmissions, figure out the protocol, and spoof the iPad. He suspected this was a systemic flaw across all rooms. And to really nail it, he kept telling the front desk he needed a new room.
I went to three, four rooms. I changed rooms continuously, which ended me in a suite. And then I had to say, I don't want this suite. I want another room.
He cracked the pattern and created a dictionary of every device. Now, under U.S. law, security researchers are obliged to tell companies about the holes they find. And Molina did that after he was safely back in the U.S. You see, there is one more key detail. Molina's luxury hotel is in China.
It would be very sad for me to end up in a Chinese jail just because I was trying to prove a point, right?
I mean, I don't know what Chinese wiretap laws, but if you wanted to try and replicate that research here, it probably would be a good idea to speak to a lawyer first.
Kurt Upsall is a lawyer with the nonprofit Electronic Frontier Foundation. He's not giving legal advice about this case or the many others he hears in Las Vegas, but he does share this rule of thumb.
One of the things that people need to be cautious of is accessing things without authorization, accessing packets without the consent of the parties involved.
Parties involved could include the company that makes the faulty product. A handful of groups are cropping up now, trying to convince companies that hackers who find and report bugs can be great for business and should get paid a bug bounty for all their hard work. Arthi Shahani, NPR News, Las Vegas.
Every summer, like clockwork, we hear stories about sharks. And this summer's been no different. As soon as people head to the beach, interest in sharks picks up. The good news is shark attacks were actually down a bit last year compared with previous years. Even so, surfers, divers, and others who spend a lot of time in the water have been buying electronic devices that help protect them against shark attacks. From Miami, NPR's Greg Allen reports.
There are two companies selling electronic anti-shark devices. One of them, Shark Shield, sells them at dive shops in Florida.
Actually, I just sent two out the door today that's going to some charter, I think, over in the Mediterranean.
Doug Austin manages Austin's Diving Center in Miami, a shop that's popular with scuba divers who often encounter sharks while spearfishing. Austin says as predators, sharks are always on the lookout for the weak and wounded.
When you shoot a fish, he is now weak and wounded. They're flailing around and sometimes bleeding, and so the sharks will come in and they will steal your fish.
The people who use them, do they come back and talk to you about them? What can I mean?
As long as they don't come back missing any limbs, I don't have a problem.
Owner and general manager of Shark Shield, Amanda Wilson, says the technology is effective because of a characteristic peculiar to sharks. They're very sensitive to electromagnetic fields.
Sharks have electrical receptors in their snout called the ampullae of Lorenzini. And the waveform that our product creates, it actually induces spasms in the shark's snout. So they don't want to come within 15 to 20 feet of the person wearing a shark shield.
Electronic shark deterrents were first developed more than 20 years ago. In that time, scientists have conducted thousands of hours of tests using chunks of fish and seal decoys protected by shark shields. Wilson says the tests show sharks recoil and avoid the device's electrical field.
Besides the scientific testing that's been done, we've got hundreds of testimonials from customers over the years that said, you know, shark was charging me, a great white was charging me, and as soon as it got to 20 feet away, it was like it hit a brick wall and just turned around.
The theory behind this device is solid.
Robert Huter is director of the Center for Shark Research at the Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota, Florida. He says the device might make sense for surfers, divers, and others who spend a lot of time around sharks and who don't mind spending $600 or $700 for the device. Huter says the question with any shark repellent is, will it work 100% of the time?
Sharks do habituate to different kinds of noxious stimuli, whether it's a smell or a sound, or in this case, an electrical burst, essentially. Will they be repelled in all cases, or will one occasionally get through?
Huter says shark researchers don't use the devices because their work doesn't often expose them to attacks. But if you're planning a 100-mile-plus open-water swim from Cuba to Key West, Diana Nyad says sharks are definitely a worry.
Kicking on the surface, you're making low-frequency vibrations. So you're making, as a lot of shark experts would tell you, the sounds of a dinner bell.
Nyad completed her Havana to Key West swim nearly a year ago, flanked by kayaks equipped with Shark Shield devices. But on her 53-hour-long swim across the Florida Strait, Nyad was also accompanied by a rotating team of divers in the water to fend off sharks.
I want to be fair and say that I felt confident that the Shark Shield was a big part of our deterrent force. On the other hand, I wouldn't have gone with just the electricity way out there. I wanted my guy.
Along with the shark shields and her team of divers, Nyad had a third line of defense. It's another new product, a chemical shark repellent sold in an aerosol can. If you're an NPR listener of a certain age, that may sound familiar.
Holy sardine!
Hand me down the shark repellent!
Unlike the shark repellent in the 1966 Batman movie, this one was developed by scientists. It puts in the water a milky chemical found in putrefied shark tissue. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Controversy is heating up around companies like Airbnb and VRBO. These companies are designed to let people rent out their homes directly, even for just a few days. Maybe you go away on vacation, so you rent your house to somebody else who's coming to your town on vacation. Now, in San Francisco, some landlords have found that renting apartments through these brokers on a nightly basis can bring in a lot more money than renting to long-term tenants. And concerns over the city's shrinking market for rental housing has prompted protests and even legal action. From member station KALW, Ben Trefney reports.
How do you spell money?
Protesters gathered in San Francisco's North Beach neighborhood recently to call attention to part of the city's housing crisis. They got together around a three-unit apartment with flats being rented out to vacationers through an online broker. This used to be the rent-controlled home of elderly tenants until out-of-town investors bought the building and evicted the residents. Ted Gullickson of the San Francisco Tenants Union says those units were added to the 7,500 or so available to tourists in San Francisco using sites like Airbnb and VRBO.
I mean, the underlying problem in San Francisco is the conversion of rent-controlled apartments to other uses, be they condo or tourist, which is taking sorely needed rent-control units off the market.
The city already has one of the lowest vacancy rates in the nation, about 3%. It's also got some of the most expensive median rents at nearly $3,300 per month. Local law limits rent increases for long-term residents, but if tenants are evicted, like they were here, they'll probably have to pay market rent to stay in the city.
you know, I applaud the tenants union for bringing attention to the bad actors.
Peter Kwan heads a group called Home Sharers of San Francisco.
But they may be giving the impression that everybody who hosts are equally bad actors, which is simply not the case.
Kwan's organization has over 1,000 members, and a lot are like him. They don't evict tenants. They live in the property they rent to tourists. Kwan gets about $130 a night for a room in his house, and it's booked pretty solid in the summer.
Oh, yeah, during the summer, it would be more than $20 a month.
So the room in your house that you rent out, mm-hmm. is that legal in San Francisco?
It could be a violation of the zoning code. I haven't looked into it.
Are you going to do that?
I may do.
There are at least two codes and ordinances that make private rentals of less than 30 days illegal in San Francisco, and two lawsuits have been filed so far. The law is the same in New York City, which has been cracking down on rental scoff laws. But San Francisco Planning Director John Ram says his city is trying to walk a fine line. It wants to protect vulnerable tenants.
And in a way that isn't causing heartache to people who are just trying to make a little bit of money out of their apartment or house.
Next month, the city's Board of Supervisors is expected to consider a compromise measure that would legalize tourist rentals, but only under some conditions. Carl Shepard, co-founder of HomeAway, which runs many vacation rental websites such as VRBO, is pro-regulation. But he says too much could just send the hot market underground.
So it's a little bit like prohibition in the 30s. And what you don't want to do is create a law that can't be enforced because that does no one any good.
Other cities around the world have made definitive choices. Amsterdam and Paris recently passed laws allowing short-term residential rentals. Berlin and Barcelona both banned them. The short-term rental arm of the so-called sharing economy will have to adjust one way or the other as regulations slowly catch up with the supply, the demand, and the technology that connect the two. For NPR News, I'm Ben Trefney in San Francisco.
It seems like not a week goes by that we don't hear about a major crime on the internet. Credit card data stolen, our home computers infected with bad software that we never downloaded. The problems of cybersecurity seem big, but also really abstract. All this week, NPR's Aarti Shahani has been in Las Vegas with thousands of experts for whom these problems are very real. Hi, Aarti.
Hi.
So we heard this week about the supposed theft of 1.2 billion usernames and passwords. That's billion with a B. That sounds like a big problem to me. Do the experts there think so?
Yes and no. It's important to keep in mind about the Russian hack that it was not independently verified. And so we don't actually know what the company has in its databases, who exactly was hacked, whether the passwords and usernames are old from 5 years ago or recent. So we have to put that in perspective.
Yeah, it seems like we're hearing about these security threats all the time. I mean, they're in the news every day. How real are they, or do they just get a lot of attention?
They definitely are real, and part of what's happening here this week in Vegas is that some of the best minds in the industry are trying to come up with solutions. And you know, some of the solutions that I've actually seen this year that I found interesting, and the variety that I've seen here is, for example, this company Tanium is working on real-time detection, meaning that, you know, it's not good enough to find out you've been breached 5 weeks or even 5 days later. To know when it's happening will actually help you to respond. So they're trying to work on systems that help corporations to do that. And apparently it's a very hard problem to even know that you've been breached. Another company that I ran into called Pindrop, which maybe I'm interested in because I'm a broadcaster, they focus on phone fraud. So apparently when you're getting a call, let's say you're working at a bank or something, and you get a call from someone who says that they're the account holder, through an analysis of the quality of their phone call, you can tell if they're on a Skype line or a regular line. And, you know, are they calling from Nigeria or Minnesota?
There's two conferences. There's the Black Hat one that we've just been talking about, but there's also DEF CON, the original conference for underground hackers. What was that scene like?
Oh, I really like the scene at DEF CON. I don't think there's a single corner of the U.S. or, you know, maybe even the world where people take their privacy more seriously.
People pay their own way, right? Why do they go?
Well, people come here for a mix of reasons, okay? Some people are coming here for skills building. There are little villages in DEF CON, as they're called. So one village, for example, teaches you how to break locks. Another village is focused on social engineering, and that's when you can learn how to use the deep web, the parts of the web that are not on Google, to fish for information, which is a great tool for a journalist to have. Other people come here for recruitment. While this is a very countercultural space and you have, you know, mohawks and tattoos, even face tattoos, This is also a place where the establishment comes over to look for their next talent. So you actually have a lot of side conversations between people that look very different, and you can tell that people are talking about jobs and career.
Have they played Spot the Fed this year? I mean, has there been any government presence? Any NSA on site?
Last year, the NSA was very much the talk of the town, particularly with the Snowden revelations. I think that this year, the assumption is, yes, obviously the government is here. Obviously, the NSA is here. That's been the case for a long time. But an interesting kind of government presence, for example, is the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, is here. And they're actually sponsoring a hackathon, a competition, because they're trying to recruit hackers to help them with the problem of phone fraud. And I think the fact that there's another kind of government agency here illustrates a bigger problem that we have across government agencies, which is that there's one that is hyper-concentrated with cybersecurity knowledge, and then every other agency is just, you know, really limping along, trying to do some basics and not having very many resources.
NPR's Aarti Shahani joining us from Las Vegas. Thank you, Aarti.
Thank you.
If you are a diehard geek or just an average civilian, it's getting easier to own drones. You can buy one online or at a store for less than $100. You can even make your own. But in New York, there are still questions about whether you're allowed to fly those drones and where, as Sarah Gonzalez of member station WNYC reports.
Drones might make you think stealth, million-dollar jets that carry bombs. But a drone is any aircraft that doesn't have passengers or a pilot on board. Think remote-controlled helicopters that are a little more sophisticated.
Time remaining, 9 minutes, 40 seconds.
In an open field at Bergen Community College in New Jersey, students fly drones they built in class.
Flight mode 2, attitude mode.
This particular model looks like a really big spider. Six arms with blades on them sticking out of what looks like a big Oreo cookie. It's about the size of a beach ball, and within a second, it can shoot up hundreds of feet in the air. Students mounted a camera to their drone and programmed it to take pictures every few seconds. Maria Alibakova says their mission is to create a 3D map of their campus.
It's like our baby, like a little baby bird flying in the sky. I feel like a bird mama.
And they can park their bird in the sky, leave it hovering up there, and make it come back home on its own.
Fail safe. Return home. 1 minute.
FAA regulations say drones shouldn't be flown above 400 feet. After that, it starts to interfere with the national airspace. They can't be flown within a few miles of an airport, and they can only be used for fun, not for commercial purposes. So you can take a video of your drone flying above a cliff and over an ocean, but you can't sell that video. And an FAA spokesman says big, congested cities like New York are off limits to drones completely, the entire city. It's called Class B airspace. But New Yorkers don't seem to know that. Unmanned aircraft are being flown all over the city.
Oh, every day.
Bill Dickey manages Pilotage Fun and Hobby in Manhattan. They sell drones. He says slate workers throw them up over a building to take pictures of some of their work.
I mean, it's been a great thing for my business because I think the drone industry is the industry for our era.
The FAA fined one resident more than $2,000 for flying a small drone off a building in Manhattan after it bumped into other buildings and landed on a public sidewalk. Peter Kalaitzidis, an Air Force vet who owns drones, says they need to be taken more seriously.
Everyone's doing these high elevated shots and they're failing. You can go on YouTube and see epic crashes all day, every day.
It's why lawmakers want more regulations. Senator Charles Schumer called New York City the Wild West of drones, and he says they threaten the privacy of citizens. The FAA is expected to issue more regulations in the fall, but Brendan Schulman, a drone lawyer in Manhattan, says there are already laws that protect against the types of illegal acts someone might commit with a drone.
So you have trespass laws, anti-stalking laws, peeping Tom laws, unlawful surveillance, and those would apply to the use of any technology.
Schulman says those who worry about drones invading their privacy overlook the good they can do. Cameras on drones have found missing children and stranded hikers.
These are real technologies that are going to save lives and help people.
Back at the campus of Bergen Community College, Professor Steve Cohen says drones are becoming a part of everyday activities. And perhaps the best indicator of that is this new trend. taking a selfie with your drone.
So, yes, taking dronies with your bronies.
Look at the pictures here.
His student, Joan Madera, shows us the aerial shots they took from their drone, and we're all in the pictures.
We took a droney!
That's going to become a thing. It's going to have its own hashtag.
It has a hashtag.
Oh, it does. Yeah. Okay.
For NPR News, I'm Sarah Gonzalez in New York.